On Lake Onega, a peaceful scene. Hiji's islands, serene and green. Its wooden churches, a timeless art, a masterpiece touching every heart. A poem about Kiji, Karelia. That's where we've come for this episode. So let's explore it for ourselves. Marina, what does Kiji mean? It's an unusual sounding name. It doesn't sound very Russian.
Well, the island's name Kiji doesn't sound very Russian indeed. You're quite right about that. According to the mostly accepted version, the name Kiji comes from the Karelian language, the language of the Karelian people. Yes. There is a word in Karelian, Kizhat, which means games or playground. So it's the island of games. Kizhat Sari in Karelian. And what kind of games are those? It is believed that there was a pagan sanctuary on this island where the local earlier worshipped pagan gods, such as the sun, mountains, and winds, and their prayers resembled dancing and maybe games. They sang, shouted, and danced, and that's how the island got its name.
So why did they set up a settlement here on this island? I think it's fair to say it's quite remote, even by today's standards, let alone in the 17th century.
Yes, indeed. And the island is far from civilization. It seems like it's at the edge of the world. But it is surrounded by a bunch of other islands. You might think, why the island of Kiji and not some other? And why not on the mainland? Well, the reason is, in the past, it made no difference where you built anything on the mainland or on an island, because the main routes were waterways. All logistics depended on water and accessible waterways. The people who once lived here worshipped their gods, so when Christianity arrived and started to replace their pagan beliefs, the missionaries who baptized them chose to build the first church on the old worship site in order to keep up tradition at this particular place and to preserve its important role, since it had already been important for the local people for a long time, and so the island continued to play its important role, and still does.
And centuries later,
Yes, that's right. It still unites people, but now with its beauty, not only through faith.
Fantastic. Now, there's a certain fairy tale or even maritime aesthetic to these churches. Why are they such an unusual shape, Marina?
The way Kiji churches were built has a deep symbolic meaning. The Church of Intercession, for example, was built to resemble a ship. Its overall layout is elongated, and its shape really resembles a ship. And it is a direct reference to Noah's Ark. The builders were deeply religious people, and they believed the church was like Noah's Ark to save people, that it's here to save humanity in the sea of life. Also, there are many domes, as many as 22. And not only is it just beautiful, it gives the church the same beautiful look on all sides, which also has a meaning. It presents an equally beautiful facade to every village, to every local household. And through that, everyone felt equal. And it contributed to overall harmony. After all, it was built with public funds. Every local family donated money for the construction.
Now, this wonderful church, it was built around 300 years ago. How is such a huge, complex wooden structure stood the test of time and it's standing to this very day? Who built it and what sort of techniques did they use?
You know, on the one hand, today we already know all the engineering secrets of how these churches were built. It has all been thoroughly studied. But you know what? I live here on the island of Kiji, and some of my neighbors are restoration artists. And in the evenings, we sometimes discuss the restoration process and how the churches were built. And they still say that every now and then the experts encounter such interesting and complex carpentry solutions that make you wonder, how did they come up with them 300 years ago? They were truly genius. They invented new joining and fitting techniques, or as they were mostly called in the past, carpentry secrets, which contribute to the stability of the overall structure made of logs. Also, in addition to genius engineering solutions, the builders had a very serious approach to the selection of wood. The churches are made mostly of pine, and pine is a resinous wood, so how did they choose their pine trees back then? They would tap the trunks and they would chop them and listen for the sound. They selected trees during the winter time when the tree sap was dormant, and they selected them based on many, many parameters. Another secret to our church's longevity has to do with the method of processing the wood. There's a special technology. They used a very sharp axe to shave every log, every wooden surface. Shaving a log with a sharp axe produced a surface with wood fibers that are tightly closed, and such a surface absorbs less rainwater.
And is it true, Marina, that this is one of the largest traditional wooden structures in the entire world?
One might assume that there could be wooden buildings elsewhere in the world that are taller, but ones as complex and large as this, I believe not. Our Church of the Transfiguration is unique that way. Just imagine, it is made of 2,500 logs, and if you were to lay them all end-to-end in a single line, it would stretch for 10 kilometers. That is a huge amount of wood and a complex structure. It is also very heavy, weighing 570 tons, and it is 41 meters tall. That is the height of a modern 12 or 13 story building, but it was built 310 years ago. It is a true architectural marvel, the eighth wonder of the world.
Really blows your mind to imagine how they built that all the way back then.
Dear Peter, it's a great honor for me to invite you to the Bell Tower to enjoy the bird's eye view of the inimitable artistic appearance of the Kyiv Architecture Ensemble.
Well, the honor would be all mine. I'd love to, Marina. Now, I've heard that the sound of the bells from this tower, they carry out across the land, far and wide, Marina, and they join in the chimes of the other bells from the other churches and create a sort of unified melody. What does it sound like?
You know, the sound of church bells has a very poetic meaning. It is called a prayer taken outside the walls of the church. It really is so, in my opinion. And the sound of bells is perhaps the only kind of music fit to reveal the beauty of prayer. Also, the ringing of bells serves some very important purposes. It invites people to the service and it marks the most important points during the service. Besides, the bells can be heard for miles and miles around. And if some people, for whatever reason, cannot come to the church, they surely can hear the bells and know it is a time for prayer. And they can pray right there and then, whatever they're doing. And on top of that, they pray together with those who are in the church.
Remote praying, yeah.
Yes, it's exactly that.
So during the restoration process, do you have to stay true to the original techniques or can you cheat?
According to all restoration standards, of course we must use the original technology, whether we work with stone or wood. Each particular piece should be restored with the materials and methods it was made of, and with. So that means we use axes and other traditional carpentry tools. But of course we also use modern technology to make the work easier. We don't have to transport logs by horse and cart, for example, or to lift them by hand anymore. So, of course, there's machinery that helps us. But when it comes to processing the wood, traditional tools are absolutely essential. If the church was built of hand-cut logs, then we make hand-cut logs. So it's a mix of modern technology and old-time techniques.
And do you still place the shingles on birch bark? Is that still really the best way to install them, or do you do something else?
The rules dictate that we must use the materials that are either the same or close to the original ones, birch bark, or skala, as it was called in the past. has remarkable properties. It does not let moisture through. It lasts and serves for a very long time. For example, ancient birch bark scrolls were found in Novgorod. They're almost 10 centuries old, and they're still intact. And the principle of sticking to the original workflow applies, of course, to the roofs too. And so birch bark is laid on top. Then we add the shingles, also made by hand. And we even use hand-forged nails, especially in visible places. We use nails that have been forged by a blacksmith for that very purpose.
Sergei, given the fact that builders back in the day tried to avoid the use of metal and nails as much as possible, was there really much work for a blacksmith to do then, or could they just sort of kick back, relax, and let the carpenters do all the work?
Back in the day, blacksmiths worked year-round because they had to prepare all the materials to make sure they had the stocks. They extracted iron ore from bogs and lakes. They had to produce charcoal, which was needed to forge the iron. And then, of course, they did the blacksmithing itself. They also had to make preparations for large-scale jobs. As for their routine job, they mostly made horseshoes or nails, like the nails that were used during the construction of the church roofs, including the roof of the Transfiguration Church here in Kizhi. They had pretty much the same tools, little hammers like these. They made the same horseshoes and the nails for attaching those horseshoes. So there was a ton of work, and the blacksmiths were constantly busy. There was a lot of hard menial labor in a blacksmith's life.
Of course. And what are we going to make today, Sergei?
We'll be making the product with the most demand, nails. We say when you've made 1,000 nails, you can try making something else. Pick up an ingot. I'll start, and then you'll give it a try. First, we need to make it thin. Now, go ahead.
Let's do it.
Closer to the tip.
Oh, I missed a bit. Sorry.
And all that work was just to make part of it thinner, so it would fit in this narrow hole. Then we use this tool to cut off the rest. It takes a few blows, and then it just breaks off on its own. And it's still hot.
I won't touch it.
Now we need to heat it up again to make the head.
How do you make sure that you stay true to the techniques and methods that they used back then, Sergei?
Well, there are usually marks left by the tools on the things blacksmiths make. I look at them and I can get an idea how they made them. The rest is done by trial and error. I try out the technique and see if it's consistent with what we know about that particular time, whether people could have used it back then or not. Now we need to heat it till 1100 Celsius. That's when this metal is ready for forging.
Would you say that it's a dying skill, blacksmithing?
No, this job is being really promoted now, and we see a lot of interest from many people. Many want to know how to make Damascus steel, for example. And now the head. Let's finish this nail. I'll start.
Okay.
Now you. And a little around the edge.
Around the edge, yeah?
That'll do. Before, people believed that you can put some of your wishes or energy into the hot metal before you cool it in water. So people used to put spells on the things they forged. Now come over here, make a wish and stir it. Stir it. Get it out. You can use your hands now.
Really?
Yes. It's not hot anymore.
It's a bit skew-whiff.
We call it a...
Kastir.
Yes.
Would they be happy with this back in the day?
It can be used as a nail.
Рабочие, that's the main thing.
So yes, it's all right.
На горушке калина, да под горою малина, ну что ж, кому дело калина, ну кому какое дело малина. Там и девица гуляла, да там и девица гуляла, ну что ж, кому дело гуляла, ну кому какое дело гуляла.
After seeing the sights of Kizhi, we're off to what locals call the Delicious Hut, where traditional Karelian pies are on the menu.
Anya, so today we're going to make kalitki. First of all, what is a kalitka and why is it called that?
Tjerfjen Peter, I greeted you in Vepsian because Veps is my native language. And today we're going to make kalitke, a traditional dish that unites the three peoples of the Republic of Karelia, Karelians, Veps, and Russians. Kalitke can be different shapes, and each is said to represent different people, but we'll make them using the same dough and the same fillings.
Perfect. Perfect, perfect. And what do we need to make a kalitka? What ingredients do we have here?
There's an old saying, a kalitka wants eight things, meaning it takes eight ingredients.
Right. And they are?
Kefir, salt, egg, then sour cream, butter, and most importantly, rye flour. And of course, to bring it all together, you always need water. When you add a filling of choice, that makes eight ingredients. Today, we'll make either potato kalitki or millet porridge kalitki.
Brilliant. And why do we use rye flour instead of wheat flour?
Here in the northern Russian climate, we can't grow wheat, which is why white wheat flour used to be the most expensive flour you could get. In fact, you might only see it once in your lifetime, at a wedding, because the bride was supposed to bake something using white flour, which she might never have even seen before.
It's hard to imagine these days.
Let's start by making the dough.
Let's do it.
We pour in the kefir, just enough to cover the bottom of the bowl. That's already enough for about 20 kalitki.
Really? Wow.
We add some salt, about 2 pinches. And now, to mix the dough. Let's use this curious-looking traditional tool.
This is just a piece of a tree.
It's made from the top of a spruce tree. The man of the house would go into the forest, find a suitable spruce tip, and bring it back to make the whisk. The number of prongs always had to be odd, usually 5 or 7. That's what made it a proper mutovka. Let's stir now. We've got kefir and salt in the bowl. Now we start adding flour by the spoonful. You can safely add 3 spoonfuls at once, and we mix it right away.
Okay. 1, 2, and 3.
Now let's mix it. With each round of mixing, it gets a bit harder because the dough becomes denser. We need to reach a consistency where the dough can be gathered together, like modeling clay, into one piece. We scrape it from the sides of the bowl and bring it all together into a single lump. Once that's done, the kneading is finished. Now we have one solid mass ready to be rolled out. Kalitki carried a lot of meaning with them. Just by looking at a kalitka, at the way its edges were pinched, you could tell which village the housewife came from, whether she was experienced or just starting to learn how to make kalitki. Grandmothers could tell right away whether she was a skilled wife or still needed practice.
Anya, do you think this is ready to be turned into a kalitka?
Wonderful! Now we're ready to prepare the dough for shaping.
How's the dough feeling?
You can touch and see how it feels. It's alive, as they say. Mm-hmm. The dough should never be stiff, so don't add too much flour.
Here we are.
So, how does it feel?
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah.
You can imagine how much strength it took. Just think, to make 100 kalitke, you needed 2 or 3 times as much dough. Imagine how strong a hostess had to be to knead all that by hand. But as people used to say, making kalitke was a joy in itself. The wife would look forward to Sundays. So, is your dough ready?
Yeah, I'd say yes.
Wonderful. Now we'll start making our own kalitke. We begin by preparing small portions of dough so that all the kalitke turn out to be the same size. In the old days, a good hostess could tear off pieces by hand without even looking, and they'd all come out even. You measure by finger, like this. That's one kalitke. Now you see why. Yes, it takes the simplest ingredients, but a kalitke must be filling, and this little piece will turn into one big kalitke.
About 20 kalitke.
We've got a lot of future kalitke here. Let me prepare it for you.
Okay.
Now you can try tearing off a piece yourself to feel the dough. Okay. Try to make them about the same size. However, big or small like that, you make them, that's how they'll be.
Okay. I'll do this one can be mine.
That one's going to be massive.
This will be my kalitke.
Now take one piece of dough in your hands. Press it gently with one palm to make a little hollow. Then roll it firmly between your hands until it forms a smooth, round ball.
Oh, we're after a ball. Okay, so...
That's one kalitke. Okay. It should be smooth without any cracks. One solid piece of dough.
How many kalitke would you say that you've made in your entire life?
This is my favorite question. At the Kiji Museum, we make about 100,000 kalitke every season. If you multiply that by the number of seasons, you'll see we've already passed a million.
Okay.
Now I'll show you how to roll out the kalitke. The skanets, rolled dough circle. It should be about the size of your palm. How to check if it's right? Hold it up to the light. It should be thin enough to see through.
I can see, yeah.
There's another old trick. Sit down and blow on it. The edge should lift slightly.
Let's do it.
Let's try it.
Definitely. Yeah, good job.
Now our skansi are ready, and it's time to add the filling. We'll use mashed potatoes and millet porridge.
Perfect.
We take the mashed potatoes. They should be prepared in advance and cooled. The traditional way is to boil the potatoes in their skins, peel them, and add milk and salt. If there's an extra egg in the house, you can add that too. And of course, butter for flavor.
Yeah.
But as we know, every family situation was different, so the fillings were different too.
Yeah.
To fold the kalitke, we start pinching from the bottom up, closing both sides at once. We fold so the dough comes slightly over the filling. That way, the kalitke won't be dry.
Okay.
The dough goes over the filling, over the filling, again and again.
So you sort of pinch it like that?
Yes, like that.
And then?
Then, with your finger, fold it over the filling, like this. There, the first kalitke of your life. And it turned out beautifully.
We can lift it up off the board as well. What a beauty.
Wonderful.
So what could I learn about you by the way you fold the kalitke?
You can actually tell a person's background by the shape of their kalitke, which people they belong to. I'm Vepsian, and the Veps still make only round kalitke to this day. In other villages, they have different shapes. But in my family, in my home, we've always made round ones. Now we place our kalitke on the baking tray.
Mm-hmm.
And they all need to be brushed to make the filling tasty and give them a nice golden crust. For the glaze, we use egg, sour cream, and a bit of salt. Now our kalitke are ready to go into the oven. Traditionally, the hostess would always have a long wooden peel to slide them in. Our tray is hot.
Uh-huh.
So we lift it carefully onto the peel, and then you send it into the oven. Peter, our kalitke are ready.
Perfect timing. I'm starving, and the tea's ready as well.
Wonderful.
Oh.
Well, I love tea, especially from a samovar.
and the moment of truth, did I make a half-decent kalitka?
Kalitki are always eaten hot, right, straight from the oven. A proper kalitka should be buttery, soaked with butter, and the wife never skimped on it. Go on, try one.
With pleasure. Freshly baked kalitki straight from the oven. What could be better?
How is it? This is a real kalitka, fresh from the oven. Kalitki were never left sitting on the table. They were always eaten right away by everyone present.
Simple, but very delicious, especially when you're hungry as well. Cheers.